we clearly were sitting later than I had thought it was. And Shockley says, look, it's time to go home, go home. He pulled out the T.S. Eliot book and started reading. It's time, gentlemen, it's time. This inability to just face up to something like that. But I could see more and more signs that he's just not communicating with what's important to people. I went to work there at the time, which was sort of an average salary, which was $675 a month. And after about 3 months, Shockley called me in and raised my salary to $850 or not, some huge raise after I'd just been there a short time. And he said, well, that'll teach you never to sell yourself out cheap again. So he could turn an extremely positive thing into an extremely negative thing without realizing he was doing it.
Right. Huh. And you saw that pattern repeat.
Yes, yeah. in all sorts of steadily, and getting steadily worse as the as Shockley's relations with Beckman deteriorated.
With Beckman personally, or with the company?
Beckman personally, I think, and Shockley, things weren't happening as fast or as well as Shockley wanted, and he had to find some scapegoat to blame for all of this, and his personality started to see more and more of the negative sides of it.
Mm.
But he had his first, I think, run-ins with Leo Valdez.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
And you may have heard Leo calling him in the middle of the night.
Yeah, that he thought it was Leo, or maybe it
was. But Shockley couldn't face him, so he called Leo's priest and had Leo's priest go to Leo and say what a terrible thing it was to keep waking this poor man up in the middle of the night.
I hadn't heard that before.
But that's just a convoluted way of approaching a problem.
Right.
So, yeah.
What, was he afraid of conflict or something?
I don't know. Mind worked so... He was so far ahead of me, technically, and so far behind me socially, that there's just no way to communicate that.
Hmm.
But I know he... and you've probably read Seitz's account of... Seitz's book, and he talks about Shockley. It's the most frank discussion of Shockley.
I haven't read that, to tell you the very truth.
Yeah, but he and Seitz were very close.
Yeah, from early
times. Early days, and then Shockley came to visit Seitz when he was on his way west.
Right.
And then he was just so... behaved so bizarrely that Seitz finally washed his hands of it.
Hmm.
That's the best discussion that I've seen of Shockley behavior.
I'll have to.
You know the book I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
Seitz's autobiography. Read the Shockley stuff in there.
Maybe we could turn and talk a little bit about some of your coworkers at Shockley during that time, to the extent that you had interactions.
Yeah, well, we interacted socially. I mean,
right.
We had parties or something like that, and I got along fine with what turned out to be the group that left. I never communicated well with Smoot Horsley, in his younger days, he ran a furniture company, so Shockley said he should be the business manager. and Valdez came and went.
Right.
And Tom Saw had joined, but he was pretty much an isolated guy doing his own stuff then.
Right.
So I liked them all a lot.
Well, what was your first impression like, if you can remember, of Gordon Moore?
kind of find him a very pleasant person, easy to talk to and easy to get to know. We seem to like each other. And I'll show you a picture.
So we were talking about Gordon Moore in those.
Just looking at this. So as Gordon and I climbed Mount Whitney together the first summer. Gordon didn't take too well the mountain climbing. He did it, but every time I bring that up again, he said, "Well, I climbed the biggest one already. There's no point going climbing anymore." So we got along well socially. I liked him a lot. I liked them all, and I got to know Jean well. We again climbed that first summer. We went and climbed Mount Shasta, and so that started something that went on for years, where Jean and I would go climbing about once a month. Climbed all over the Southern California and Northern Mexico. And we did the same thing with Sheldon, who was also a climber. So I got to know Sheldon and Jean well as a result of camping out with them and climbing.
Right.
And so that continued. Gordon had a very rich home life and go home at night, and that was it. And I saw Bob once in a while. I went skiing with Bob. And then I had an unfortunate incident with Bob that maybe I think has been written someplace, so I'll discuss it. Where this was the next year when my relationship with Shockley had really started to deteriorate, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And Bob was sort of the de facto leader. And I went to him and said, "Look, Bob, in confidence, I'm just having this real problem with Shockley. Can you give me some guidance? What I'm doing wrong, or what's happening?"
What were the problems like that you were experiencing?
I'm drawing blanks on this, but I could see I was going to be the focus of blame for things that weren't happening well, and this is what happened to everybody eventually, pretty much. So I told all this to Bob. And 5 minutes later, Shaka came storming out and said, "What the hell is that you're telling noise about?" And I said, "Bob's off my list from now on as far as sharing any confidence with him ever."
And that was it. That's early on. I guess we'll get to that, but you continued to work with him for the next 3-4 years?
But I obviously remembered that
incident
and his approach to it.
Which was just to go right and tell Shockley.
Brad to Shockley, and it just flabbergasted me. And by then, I mean, everything, it was just turning into a circus there, you know, all these other things. One thing that Shockley told me a story, and I could see it was more than a joke to him. It was something fairly serious. It was about a fellow in a mental institution that's looking out through the bars and sees a truck driving under an underpass, and a truck gets stuck. And they can't figure out how to get the truck out, and the guy in the asylum shouts out, "Well, just let the air out of the tires a little bit, and then you can push it through." And they said, "Well, how's the guy in a mental institution figure that out?" And the guy said, "I may be crazy, but I'm not stupid." And I could see sort of a tension in his voice when he was telling me. And he told that story to me twice. So I could
tell that.
I could see something that he was thinking along these lines, that with his brilliance, he had some very serious other problems. Yeah, I don't know how much that he wrote in his diary about his feelings about this. I've never seen the that kind of stuff.
No, very well. From the material that I saw, it's very. It's not. It's more of a log than a diary. You know what I mean? It's not very
phone conversation.
Yeah, you know, resigns on this day. Things.
That's what I would guess it would be.
That's interesting.
But my relations with him were great. When he went to Sweden to get the Nobel Prize, he called me from Sweden to discuss what my work was coming along, and I was really at the top of his list. And then as this Pin affair developed, I think that was a key moment when the
broken pin.
A broken pin, and he wanted everybody to take lie detector tests, which I was never confronted him directly on that. But I would obviously resign before I would go through an experience like that. So I started there in April. The Nobel Prize was like November. From then on, it was downhill. Shockley was gone quite a bit of the time. He was back in Woods Hole on some kind of a government advisory board sort of a thing. And he was running off doing that. And puts Smoot Horsley in charge. And so things were, November still good. In February, Vic Jones had it. I was very close to Vic, and he and I climbed together too. And Vic left, and Shockley helped get him a job as a professor at Harvard. Vic spent the rest of his career. I lost touch with him, but so I have some notes that in January of 59, after the place had been in business for under a year, there was some group, semi-revolt, saying that we have to have more control over our own life, and you can't keep running us this way.
In 57.
That'd be January of 59. I have some notes in there.
In your group.
And I don't remember that, just the notes I have. And so Vic left in February, and April I was still on good enough terms with Shockley that I realized I had to get out of there. And I went to Shockley and said, "Hey, Bill, I'd like to take a year's leave of absence." And because I figured after a year he'd be gone and said settle down. And Beckman has these offices in Munich.
Right.
And could I, go over there for a year and sort of do the Beckman stuff for a year? And Shockley agreed and started writing letters. And so in April that year, I was still communicating with him enough to have that interaction.
Right.
Although I was looking for a graceful way out.
Well, I was curious about maybe I would like to return to some other questions about the Shockley period, but the group that eventually did leave together, I was very interested in how that group that left, Shockley to form Fairchild, how that group coalesced, how that conversation began. Because I wouldn't imagine that would be a straightforward thing to...
I think it goes back to that January meeting that I had mentioned where we were sort of putting it out on the line together, and we could see kindred souls in this problem. And the group of us that eventually left together were ones who started talking among ourselves. Noyce was not a part of this process.
Right. Until much later.
Until it was accomplished fact that we were indeed leaving, and then he got involved. But it was partially, you know, I think a loyalty to Shockley and a number of reasons. But it was the seven of us that talked, and I know there'd be the occasional party at somebody's house, and we'd, you know, always get to talk about that a bit.
Sure.
And I don't recall why it was, but John Sheldon and I were the three that got on Shockley's list as being the cause of his problems. And my communication with him essentially broke down at that point.
After that sort of April period.
Yeah.
And is this was that the point in time when he did this? I've heard a number of people have spoken about it, this PhD production line that seemed to, a couple people recall falling on.
He was going to get supervise our work directly, and you know, want immediate outputs and all that. As I say, that stuff is pretty vague to me now.
Right.
It was very painful at the time. But I knew I was going to be out of there sooner or later, and then we had, and things then just turned into a big morass. This Penn affair was sort of the breaking point, and I realized that here's a man that has some mental problems of some sort.
Right.
And Sheldon was the one who pointed out to him that his pin fell off. It wasn't some malicious person running around here trying to stab people. and the messenger never gets a good report on the way his message is received.
So. Right.
And John is a pretty cranky guy and a delightful person, but he has a very cranky streak. And so the three of us, I think, had the worst relationship. Hap and these people just never entered into our discussions. They were just in another world, and I just had no.
What about were there any people more active than others in this sort of discussion among the seven of you?
I don't recall.
Yeah.
John and Sheldon and I went climbing, and then we had very active discussions about it then.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very close to John by that time, and we had a lot of our own discussions.
Mm-hmm. But, what was Gordon Moore's role? Was he in there with you, or how would you characterize that?
Well, as I said, I hardly ever saw him, except unless it would be some formal party or something.
Right.
And our climbing, but we did, took our climbing trip together, you know, all the sweetness in life. And so I think that there was some meeting, I'm very vague on the details, where Shockley, when we were all there, sailed into Beckman, and I just vaguely remember that. It just struck me as very bizarre, I know. But we could all see that the group of us that did leave, that we were going to, somehow or another, it was in an intolerable situation. Yeah, it was getting worse.
In some accounts that I've read and in some discussions with folks, it seemed like that incident of Shockley saying, you know, well, I can take this group and go to wherever I want, you know, to Arnold Beckman, that seemed to be precipitate some action, namely, I guess, you know, a phone call from Gordon Moore to Arnold Beckman.
Yeah.
Do you remember that development?
I remember. I can see that in my mind.
Can you tell me about it?
Yes, we went to lunch, there's seven of us, and we said, you know, we got to start doing something here. And we had a lunch at a German restaurant there, and we came back, and we were still rumbling, and Vic Greenwich said, look, we got to do something right now. You either do it or quit doing it, but take some action. And so we got to call Beckman. And who's going to make the call? And there was a lot of hemming and hawing. And for the first time, I saw Gordon Moore's real strength. He said, I'll do it.
Really? Hmm.
And he picked up the phone. I could still hear the sort of quaver in his voice, but he was the one that did it. And he called Beckman, and Beckman wasn't in. So then later on, where I was not there, he did it either from his house or John's house or
right.
someplace. He called him that evening or something, and Beckman said he was coming up, talk to us.
And then there was a series of dinner meetings, was it not? With
Beckman.
With Beckman, mm-hmm. Yeah. Could you tell me about
that? Oh, this is the first time I'd ever met anybody that was rich and successful businessman. Yeah, I was very impressed with him. And he was paying for dinner with $100 bills, which I'd never seen one. And after one of these meetings, I got along with him real well. He was a real nice guy. And he said, oh, I feel like $1 million. And I said, does that mean you feel good or you feel bad? Because he was impressively wealthy at that point.
Sure.
And so it was a nice situation. I feel comfortable making a remark like that.
Right.
And Beckman went through all the things, and you know, no one person is bigger than the group, and the group is so on and so forth. And so, as you heard his account, I'm
well,
sure, but he looked like he was going to support our group and really restrict Shockley's ability to do the damaging things he
mm-hmm.
was doing. And that went along fine until that final meeting where Beckman said, Shockley's going to run the place, and if you don't like it, that's tough.
And that was at a dinner meeting?
No, that was a Saturday afternoon meeting. Shockley was there with his wife looking for nervous twitches. Yeah. And
of the whole staff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The staff of us that were involved in this.
Uh-huh.
The others. It was just the ones that were the group of seven.
Hmm.
And I went into that meeting. I remember clearly standing outside and said, look, I've got an exit here. If this, you know, because I'm going to leave and go to Munich anyhow. But I'm telling you, if I walk through that door, I'm not going to Munich no matter what happens. So I'm with it. I'm with the group here.
Right.
Whatever happens, happens.
Hmm.
And then we saw that Shockley, I think, my best analysis of it was that Shockley had Beckman had talks with Jack Morton at Bell Labs. And Morton says, look, are you going to back a Nobel Prize winner or seven young dissident punks?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, to that effect. And Shockley, and I think he persuaded, Morton persuaded Beckman that Shockley was the one he had to cater to.
Hmm. Why do you think it was Morton?
At the time, I thought there was some relationship maybe between Beckman and Morton or something, or Morton was way up in the organization. And,
yeah.
Wasn't directly involved with taking some of the stuff that Shockley was handing out to the people there.
Right.
Hmm. Sort of a senior citizen kind of a guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I could be completely wrong just, on all of this, but
no, but
no, that would make sense.
It would.
Why Beckman changed his thinking.
A lot of people speculate that he spoke to someone at Bell Labs who, you know, persuaded him to go the other way. And so what was, so when you heard that, what was your...
Well, John and I was just flabbergasted. And John and I walked right out of the meeting, still in our business suits, and drove to Yosemite. And went, got there late on Saturday night and climbed, took a very tough climb on Sunday and came back. But I could see it was over. And I, as I said, this was extremely painful for me. This abuse and shock. I'd go home at night and just sort of stare at the ceiling and couldn't sleep. I was just out of school. And here I had great dreams of having a nice research career, and here I was in the middle of this stuff.
Right.
So it was pretty tough on me. And as I said, I blanked out.
Sure.
The worst aspects of it. But Shockley and his wife were a bad combination as far as, I mean, his wife, you know, was egging him on and trying to make psychoanalysis.
Right.
And I often speculate why she would put his papers in the public domain.
You mean his papers now?
At Stanford.
Well, tell me more about that.
No, I'm just thinking. She was working hard to... She was extremely protective of him. And of his, presumably his reputation. And some of this stuff wasn't going to help it.
Yeah, that's true.
But she did. And I don't know how easily accessible those papers are or how well they're cataloged.
They're not cataloged at all.
And that's one reason I think about Stanford, is just putting it there and have it sit in a box. It doesn't do any good.
Well, there may be, who knows what the discussion was that's led to that situation. You know, it could be.
Yeah, it could be.
You could make it very clear. Had the group of that group of the seven of you then had discussions about having a common exit strategy then?
Well, after that horrible Saturday meeting, things had just blown up. We could see that. I have some notes that Beckman said, if you don't like it, you have to leave. But this is the way it is. So we all said, well, to ourselves, we have to leave.
Well.
And then we got together at, I can see the room, but I can't remember whose house it was, but it was like on a Friday night, from the evening. And we were, realized that in the group of the seven of us, it represented all of the technology. I mean, other people might have been redundant. A fellow who doesn't get all the credit he deserves was Dave Allison. Dave Allison was the great diffusion guy.
Really?
And he joined us right after we left, but he wasn't part of that original group.
But he was on staff at Shockley.
Yeah.
And what was his background?
I have a bio of him someplace here. He had a master's degree in physical chemistry or something like that. And he was one of the leading stars in diffusion, both at Shockley and at Fairchild.
Did he and Gordon Moore work together?
I believe they did. By then, Jean Hernie was involved in diffusion too, so those were the three diffusion guys. And Sheldon was working on crystal growing.
Right.
And I, as I said, I was good friends with him. Kleiner, you know, was a very reserved, dignified guy. I always had found my relationship pleasant, but not terribly close.
Mm-hmm.
Julie Blank I was very close with. We were just on the same wavelength, and we were always laughing about something or other. Vic Greenwich and I, God, Vic had just a marvelous sense of humor. And that was the thing that kept us all going together. It was fun being with these guys. There was always a joke or something pleasant happening.
That sounds great.
It was a really great group. And so we got to, the group of seven of us got together, and Gene Kleiner had this idea of, say, I know, we were saying, is there some way that we can all be hired together, and we could be a big asset to some company? And we weren't thinking beyond that.